We're looking at the late Rishonim. Now we're gonna. You can't talk about everybody, but certain people you have to talk about. The Maharil. His real name was Rabbi Yaakov Malin. He lived from 1365. Malin. I'm not sure why he's called Maharil. That's a good question. That's what he's called.
Was he
I'm not sure what.
Late
Rishav, 1365 to 1427. He lived in Mainz and Worms. And as I pointed out last week, at this point in Ashkenaz, and amongst Ashkenazi Jewry in Germany, that is, we're going to speak about Poland next week. Well, I expect a lot better attendance from Shana Aleph, guys.
100% of
Shana. Yeah, no, I'm sure it'll be well attended. In Germany proper, the main place Jews were living were in the ecclesiastic states. Because again, another one of the ironies of Jewish history is the ecclesiastic states. I mean, states ruled by the church did not usually, almost never, expel Jews.
Ecclesiastic
means. Yeah, well, it means in this, that's ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastic states means church states. I don't know what that is the term used. I mean, English is a funny language. We all know that. And once a name tag gets stuck on something, it's there. It doesn't matter how it got there and what it means, and no one really cares anymore.
What does ecclesiastic mean?
Well, it probably does mean something to do with gather, with group and gathering, because ecclesiastes means congregation. Yeah, so it's yeah, congregational. Yeah, that's very good. Menachem is very good. It probably means congregational. In other words, in theory, church land is congregational. In theory. So, very good. Anyway, again, that's where most proper Ashkenazi, German Ashkenazi Jews were. The Maharil is very, very important in terms of, founding proper Nusach Ashkenaz. The Rishonim pre-Maharil, I wouldn't say they have nothing to do with the issues, but, Rishonim are Rishonim. We'll go with the Rashba sometimes. We'll go with this, we'll go with that, we'll go with the next. Do Ashkenazim favor Tosis over the Rambam? A little bit, but it's not direct. When we talk about direct evolution of Minhag Ashkenaz, it's really starting with the Maharil. There are a smidgen of things pre-Maharil, but the Maharil is the really real beginning of Minhag Ashkenaz. I actually last year learnt Maharil with Nasi. It was a lot of fun. I didn't think it would be. He mamash had to twist my arm to make me do it. And Rebbe, this is what we're going to do. I said, "You really want to do this, Nasi?" I don't know. That's what we're going to do. I thought it was a lot of fun because there's two things. First of all, the Maharil again is a prime source for many minhagim. If you are knowledgeable of Mishnah Berurah, Shulchan Aruch, Aruch Chaim, Mishnah Berurah, you will find the Maharil very interesting. It's sort of like certain poskim adapt like a semi-conversational style, and the Maharil is one of them. Like, throws in stories. It's like, it's really interesting. It's like, other poskim try to eliminate all that. They think, that's not important. Stick with the Zugya. But the Maharil doesn't. I'll give you an example. It's such a great example. Okay. The Maharil says that you have to say that the piyutim are like a very key part of Minhag Ashkenaz. Ashkenazim like saying piyutim. I mean, at one time in history. And you can't, if the shul is saying piyutim, even if you're a learned person, and you're not going to get that much out of key with dominating up the piyutim, you should do it anyway. Say the piyutim. However, if the congregation is singing, You can feel free to open a sefer. that's like a paraphrase, but it says that the Mariel, if they were singing in Kedusha, you know, like just Stam singing, so the Mariel would like open up a sefer.
I like it. Sounds
good. So, okay. So, that's the Mariel. The other very, very key part of Nusach Ashkenaz is the Trumas Hadashin. He's known as Rabbi Yisrael Israelin, 1390 to 1460. For some reason or another, the Poskim call him Maharai. I don't know why, but I'm telling you that's what the Poskim call him consistently. Kasav Maharai, Kasav Bimharai. The Trumas Hadashin is, as is well known, it's Shailos and Shuvas Ki'ilu, but is well known, the Shailos really are like, you know, made up. And the Shailos are written in order to write the Shuvas.
Is that uncommon?
That is uncommon, yes, that is uncommon. Most Shailos and Shuvas is very clear that the Shaila is real, and the Tshuva obviously is real, but it's unclear if the Trumas Hadashin had originally had Shailos, and just felt that the Shaila wasn't that important, and just condensed it down to the specific halachic issue, and then wrote on the issue. Or did the Mariel just simply want to write about, the Maharai, I mean, the Trumas Hadashin just want to write about certain things which came up in his own life, or he had theory about, and it's unclear. Okay. Now, what is very clear from the Trumas Hadashin is the Trumas Hadashin, the Maharai, does not consider himself an equal with the Rishonim. There are places where there's a very famous case in Hilchos Shabbos where he quotes Yesh Misha Kasav, and we don't know, we don't have any Rishon, we are not in possession of any Rishon saying such a thing. He said, whatever, it's not, I don't want to get bogged down and explain exactly. So Yesh Misha Kasav, someone says X, and we don't have any Rishon who says that. And there's a lot of kashas on it, it doesn't make that much sense. End of the day, the Trumas Hadashin says someone well before me. One assumes it's someone, let's say, about 100 years before them, the Trumas Hadashin. And v'halacha l'maisa, we're still machmer for it. Because the Trumas Hadashin says it's a Rishon who I can't argue with, even though I don't understand why he learned the sugya this way.
What did he say?
No, not in the middle of history class. I tell you, ask me Shabbos, I'll tell you Shabbos. Okay. So last week I told you why I define Rishonim the way I define Rishonim. Now I'm giving you a really very practical example. I mean, we relate to the Trumas Hadashin like a Rishon. In other words, he says something, we assume it's, we don't, an Akhra's, a late Akhra is not going to argue unless there's, he says, most Rishonim argue with the Trumas Hadashin. But we're not going to argue with the Trumas Hadashin as an equal, but the Trumas Hadashin himself did not consider himself an equal to the Rishonim, certainly not to Rashi, Tosfos, and the Rambam. Certainly didn't have didn't think that at all, but even to the later Rishonim, he didn't consider himself equal. So that's how I say that's the real proof. The real proof our scroll says he's in the art scroll that we showed him. However, it's really a borderline period. It's really a borderline period, and he's really, you know, he's quite not quite here, not quite there. Okay. Now, I once heard, and I'm not sure if this is true, but I once heard that every psak of the Trumas Hadashin is either mentioned in Shulchan Aruch or the Main Nosei Kelim. I'm not sure if that's true, and I was not able to track it down. But that's what people say. What? Who? I heard it like 20 years ago, so it's 15 to 20 years ago. So it's hard for me to remember who I heard it from.
Every Shulchan as well?
Every question in the Trumas Hadashin, every one of the pieces of Torah in the Trumas Hadashin is brought l'halacha. Okay, I don't know if that's true or not, but okay, that's a fact. That's facts. That's what people say. Okay. Now let's get back to some one of the most key important events that at least the general historians feel is very key and important, and that is the rise of the Ottoman Empire and the fall of Constantinople, of the Eastern Roman Empire. 14, yes. Kopchak?
1400s.
Okay, that's good. That's good. 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue.
It's 1492, I
discovered he was.
He did not, he was not Jewish.
He wasn't.
Early 1400s.
1453. Historians consider the modern world beginning with the fall of the Eastern Roman Empire in 1453. Now what's like historically interesting is that the, you know, if the Holy Roman Empire was neither holy nor Roman nor an empire, then the Eastern Roman Empire had not really been a significant kingdom for at least 150 years, and really for over 250 years. I mean, in the early 1200s, in one of the Crusades, the Crusaders got distracted in Constantinople and sacked the city. And that's really, they weren't really successful in long term.
Why was there such a big divide in Christianity?
Why was there division? I'm a Aris in it, but I haven't gone over it recently, so I'm not going to. I mean, there's a couple of differences. Is the papacy independent? The Eastern Empire doesn't recognize it. There's a number of theological issues.
Easter.
The time issues are different. Okay, fine. Anyway, whatever. That's because the Gregorian calendar. Because the person who changed the calendar was a pope in the late 1500s, early 1600s. Pretty sure it's the late 1500s. And on principle, non-Catholics refused to accept it. So yeah, on principle, the non-Catholics refused to accept it. Which is why it wasn't really accepted in the Western world, in the Protestant Western world, until after the French Revolution. Which is why there's two George Washington's birthdays. New style, old style. Yeah, you guys don't know this. Okay. Fine. So this is why, in other words, July 4th is not really July 4th. It should really be July 15th.
Okay.
Okay. But don't tell anyone shooting up there. Okay, fine. So Russia, being very, very stubborn, refused to accept it until the Communist Revolution. Okay, that's nothing. That's very, like, pretty nice divergence here. Okay, the Ottoman Turks. Constantinople, we know what that's called today?
Istanbul.
Okay, yeah, you never know. I don't know. You never know. People know anymore. There's a song about it, I hear. Okay, that must be. Now, I wasn't able... Does anyone know where the Turks really start, come from? Does anyone know where the Turks originate from?
Turkey?
Nope. Modern-day Turkey is not... Modern-day Turkey, historically speaking, in other words, if we say human history... is, let's say, around 4,000 years old, 4,500 years old. Turkey, modern-day Turkey, for most of that time was Greek.
Saudi Arabia?
Nope.
I think it was Spain.
Nope.
Morocco?
Nope. Wrong way, guys. Okay. The Chinese example of barbarians are Turks.
Oh, Mongols.
I was going to say Mongols.
There's China... Mongols, Turks. Okay? So there's a lot of Turkish tribes. The Huns are Mongols.
That's just in a stupid Disney movie.
Okay. No, the term Huns is used for Mongols. I'm not sure the Attila the Hun really did exist.
They never gave the Chinese to attack the Romans.
Yeah, okay. Anyway, now the Turks really start in Turkestan, which is northeast of India. They were driven. I mean, barbarian nomads by definition sometimes decide to go on big fun barbarian raids. They eventually converted to Islam. That's right.
Were they eventually bordering China?
They're not mamish bordering China, but they're close enough. Chinese are aware of Turks.
What was it between China and...
There's a big desert called the Gobi Desert.
Oh,
and right on top of it are the Mongols, and right. The other side of it are the Turks. So they eventually, you know, they realized that the Eastern Roman Empire, the Byzantines, were... Word got out that there's a lot of money there. And they're in a state of excessive decay. And the Turks started coming. First, they're different. The Turks, the term Ottoman means they followed some guy by the name of Osman. Now, how you get from Osman to Ottoman, I'm not sure. And Wikipedia isn't either. And Wikipedia is not either. So Rafi says maybe it was originally Othman. Maybe, maybe not. I don't know. It could be. I thought of that myself, but I'm not sure. So the Ottoman Turks start seriously as a serious, you know, group in the mid-late 1300s. They conquer the Balkans up to Serbia, which means up through southern Yugoslavia. Oh, you guys know where Serbia is today?
Yeah,
they remade the country. So they defeated the Serbs in Kosovo in 1389. What? And they ruled the Serbs for about 500 years. Approximately, practically. So the Ottoman Empire is the last of the great, you know, like, it's like in a certain sense a linear descendant of the Eastern Roman Empire, and eventually, a little after our times, they're going to rule all the way from Hungary
to Romania.
Hungary, all the way down all the Balkans, Yugoslavia, Romania, Bulgaria, Greece, Albania, Turkey, Syria, Iraq, Israel, Egypt, Libya, Tunisia, part of Saudi Arabia, the important parts of Mecca, Medina, Tunisia, and Algeria. That's impressive. That is they ruled at their peak half of the Mediterranean basin, practically. What? Practically the Mahadevakush. Now, of course, in early modern times when it could take you months to get from one place to another. Obviously, the governors of these, you know, provinces out here and there and the next had a large amount of independence. But at the end of the day, the Sultan of Constantinople or the Grand Vizier was the man really in charge. And they were able to, you know, combine forces, etc. Now, it's not... How were they so successful? And they were a very successful group. How were they so successful? So the truth is, if you want to know part of the real answer, is Hashgacha Pratis. I mean, Hashgacha Pratis is they had a number of very, very competent rulers, almost one after another. They had a number of highly competent rulers, one after another. And that's like that's like one of the enigmas of history, Kielo, in a certain sense. It's a historical enigma, which there's no real answer for, besides Hashgacha Pratis. So how you know? I'll explain what I mean. Anyone knows who ruled, what the name of the German emperor was before in the time of the First World War?
Is it Wilhelm?
William II. Wilhelm or William II. He actually spoke English fluently. His mother was English, and the English called him Willie. Willie. Yeah, he had a certain. It's true. He had a certain inferiority complex with the English. Which is complicated, but not.
Like half the people involved in World War One, like the rulers, all related.
They almost were all related to each other. Yes, absolutely.
It was like a failure.
One big Italian family.
Yeah, okay. Anyway, William II of Germany had a lot of power. If he would have known what he was doing, he could have really effectively ruled Germany. Problem is there's no one who thinks he knew what he was doing. And what's bizarre is that Bismarck, Keilo, who ruled Germany before him, in other words, in the name of his grandfather and father, he had practically monarchical power. It's just he wasn't born a monarch. But if he would have been born a monarch, I mean, it's like, you understand? It's like, that's just such a, how is it that this guy here, it's like funny. It's not funny. It's plus straight hashgacha. I mean, you have a whole set, which is, we're not going to get to this year at all, but you have a whole set of early modern rulers. Joseph II of Austria, Frederick the Great, Prussia. These rulers, they were exceptional rulers. And one there's no reason to believe that if they would have been born 100 years later, that they would have been unsuccessful. And again, William II had slightly less power than Frederick the Great, but he didn't know what to do with it. He didn't know how to exercise it. There's a different phrase that historians / political analysis say, which is that some people know how to rule and some people know how to delegate. But that's important, you know? It's like in the prime ministers, for example. That's a great point. In the prime ministers, when he met Reagan the first time, Yehuda Avner, the writer, he was like shocked. Reagan was using cards.
Cue cards.
He was using cue cards to make sure he said the right thing. To Avner and whoever the prime minister was. One guesses it was Begin. Must have had to be Begin. He was using cue cards to say the right thing to Begin. And Avner was like, he was like shocked. He had dealt with 4 or 5 different presidents, and none of them used cue cards. And the liberal press like to make fun of Reagan's not being the world's most intelligent person. And he was certainly of average intelligence. I'm not, the Reaganites, an honest Reaganite / Republican, etc. This isn't going to say Reagan was brilliant, because he wasn't. I mean, Jimmy Carter was intelligently-wise a lot more smarter man. There's no question about it. As a politician, there's no question Reagan was a better politician. And even if he wasn't brilliant and was not able to penetrate policy completely, he had a good gut feeling of what's good for America. That's A. I mean, you don't have to agree with every policy, but he had good gut feeling. But more importantly, he knew how to delegate. And that's very important. What was that one?
Said he's a
shaker. Yeah, okay. Let's not get involved in American politics.
No.
Let's not get emotional about American politics. Okay, so fine. So the facts are, is there's two things here. One thing is the early Ottoman Empire from the around 1350 till around 1570 didn't have an inept ruler. All the rulers were either good, very good, or great. So that's just hashgacha. There's no answer. The only answer to why how that happens is hashgacha. There's no other answer. There's no other real answer to that. The other thing is very important, and this is very important, is they did also have a tradition of tolerance. They had a tradition, and that tolerance, Muslims have to an extent a tradition of tolerance, but the Ottomans, no, it's more, modern day Islam is different, and I guess we'll explain that a little bit right now. Say again? They were who?
Second class
citizens. No, we'll get there. You're right. Yedimis, there is such a concept, but you're right. It doesn't mean modern tolerance of everyone is an equal citizen in the state. That's true. But Muslims, by and large, classically had more tolerance than Christians. Of not only Jews, but of Muslims. In other words, Muslims never expelled Christians from their countries, and the Christians expelled Muslims from their countries. That's A. But the Turks were a little farther, a little more liberal than that. Also, again, not for completely understood reasons. That's just, again, that's a quantified fact. And they also had, again, they had a tradition of minimal interference. Is pay us taxes, and we will more or less let you run your own affairs. And most people were happier that. Most historians believe the reason why they conquered the Balkans, they conquered the lower Balkans in the early 1300s, and then the mid Balkans up to Serbia in the late 1300s, and the people there were very happy under Ottoman rule for hundreds of years, and the reason why is because they were fair rulers. They didn't oppress. They said, okay, you give us X amount of tax and run your own affairs after that. And they didn't try to force them to convert. They didn't try this, they didn't try that. And people were happy. Specifically speaking, Greece, which had been ruled earlier by Italians and Franks, Franks mean Norman Franks, mean French, exiled French noblemen who were really originally of Scandinavian descent. They were rapacious rulers who wanted too much taxes, interfered way too much, etc., etc. And the Greeks were a lot happier. The Greeks were a lot happier under Ottoman rule. Okay, fine. And again, for the Jews, it was the Turks were good. And again, most specifically, there's two things going on here. Most specifically, and I'm not sure if this is 100% true. I didn't have time to double check it. Classically, people tell you that one of the reasons why the Spanish and the Portuguese embarked on voyages of discovery. One of the reasons was because when Constantinople fell, the classic trade routes were closed and they had to find new routes. And I'm not sure if that's really true. I'm not sure how true that is, but could be. That could be. But in terms of Jewish history, there's something which is, I've seen a number of times, and a lot of people have heard it. But it's not really accurate at all. And that is, it's true the Jews were thrown out of Spain in 1492, but America was discovered. But you know what? I'll tell you something. The American continent was not really a place for Jews to go to until the 1700s, and in a real way, the 1800s and late 1800s. And in terms of Jewish history, Ki'ilu, the place where Jews were able to run away to because of the expulsion of Spain was the Ottoman Empire. That was the real, you want to know, the real, in historical terms, what the balance to being thrown out of Spain was, it was the Ottoman Empire. And the rise of the Ottoman Empire.
Was there more Eastern Europe?
Say again?
Eastern Europe,
no. Most Jews from Eastern Europe are of Ashkenazi descent, of German descent. There, of course, are some of Sephardi descent. The Jews from Spain. We'll get there. I'm not sure if we'll get there tonight, but we'll get there. We'll get there. Okay, back to Spain. Okay, Spain has been divided, as we should know, into four countries. One of them is very minor. It's called Navarre. I barely mentioned it. And they were really out of the, they're really out of the picture as a player in big Spanish politics. There are two/three countries: Aragon, Castile, and Portugal. Those are the three countries, the three prime countries in Spain. Now, the way kings work, as someone pointed out earlier. It was true in the First World War. It was true in Spain also 500 to 700 years ago. As the kings married their cousins over and over and over. And in Spain, each one of the prime countries, Portugal, that means Portugal, Castile, and Aragon, each one was hoping to unite Spain under themselves. So each one would marry their cousins / the rival dynasty. I mean, not exclusively, but largely happened over and over. However, of course, it was quite fluid is the right words for this one, and it wasn't clear at all what was going to happen. But eventually, in 1469, very fateful shidduch is made between
Ferdinand and Isabella.
Yeah, you didn't know that, yes? You heard of it. Okay. Ferdinand was the heir to Aragon. Isabella was the heir to Castile. Ferdinand had certain claims on the Castilian throne, though. They weren't really legally recognized. They got married, and even a greater historical irony. Now, you understand that Castilians and Aragonese hate each other. And each one, all these three Spanish groups all consider themselves the greatest. All very proud of their, you know, lineage and consider themselves the greatest. And each one was very hesitant that the other one should not dominate them. And even though, historically speaking, it's true that even Portugal was under Spanish rule for about 100 years, it was a very uneasy pact. And the Portuguese really don't like the Spanish. I mean, seriously. If they didn't have a choice, whatever. I'm not sure. It's not really going to come that much in here, but it'll come in a little bit. Maybe we can get to it before Pesach. So the same thing was true about the Castilians and the Aragonese. So the Castilians were, of course, very hesitant to make a shidduch, to allow the king and the noblemen were very hesitant to marry the heir to the throne. The heiress to the throne is a woman. To marry her off to the heir to Aragon was considered not so pashut. So the Jews got involved. And Jewish bankers convinced the Castilian throne and the noblemen that it's a good idea.
Why?
They were just naive. They thought that if they make the shidduch, that Ferdinand and Isabella will be makar tov, will reciprocate and thank them for it, and will ease up the problem the Jews are facing.
They would be appreciative because they knew that.
They thought they would be appreciative. That's right. They were highly, highly mistaken. And this is the Rambam, which I don't think I mentioned this when I spoke about the Rambam. The Rambam, in one of his igros, in one of his letters, he, in a veiled comment, you know, people knew the Rambam was a great doctor. And the well-to-do Jews in Egypt wanted him to get very involved in the Sultan's court well before he did. And the Rambam was just not interested. And approximately, I didn't have time to look up the Rambam last night, but approximately the Lashon, the Rambam says, all of these maneuvers, political maneuvers that the well-to-do Jews make, maybe I did quote this to you guys, in my opinion, are not of that much of a positive effect, and no small negative effect either. All of these political maneuverings, the Rambam writes in a very casual language, the political maneuverings that these Jewish activists make are not of positive effect. They're not of a small amount of negative effect either. So we have here another example of well-meaning Jewish activists who thought they were going to solve Judaism's problems, coming and without a question compounding it. Now, there is a very important fact, and this is, again, historically this is true. In modern days it's not true, and I'm going to explain it to you right now, at least in my opinion, and I'm basing myself on the Rambam. There's, traditionally speaking, pre-modern world, the Western powers are good to Jews when and only when they need them. When they can make profit, that's when they're good to Jews. Muslim powers, the Rambam explains that Muslims view political power with a religious twist. And being politically in charge, they consider that a significant religious accomplishment. And in my opinion, that's why the peak of the Ottoman Empire, for example, and the peak of Muslim Spain, Jews were doing great. And the peak of the Ottoman Empire, they did not have any internal need for the Jews. A Christian state at that point, like Spain, expelled the Jews under those circumstances. Muslim country didn't, because the Muslims felt that their political domination and the Jews being a minor cog in their empire was enough. That religiously satisfied them, and they felt superior because of that. So that's an important rule that definitely applied in, you know, pre-revolutionary. Once you get to, you know, revolutionary ideas, French Revolution, etc., things change. But it's a question how much they change, but they definitely change. Things today are a little different, but they're the same and they're different all at the same time. Okay, now Ferdinand, and I was not able, unfortunately, not able to track this one down. Ferdinand, according to what I know, people believe, or I'm not sure if Machiavelli says this explicitly, but I definitely saw somewhere that Machiavelli wrote, we've heard of Machiavelli?
Yeah.
Yes, yeah. Machiavelli, the prince. You know who the prince was about?
Machiavelli.
Who?
What?
Who was the prince about? Ferdinand.
It was about Ferdinand.
He doesn't mention him by name. He doesn't mention him by name. But he talks about the prince is Machiavelli's famous early political treatise about the way an absolute monarch should engage in politics, etc. And people, I don't know if it says it explicitly or if he said it sometime. But people say that he modeled the book on Ferdinand of Aragon. It might partially be, but it's not completely. Listen, Ferdinand of Aragon was one of the wiliest, shrewdest rulers that we know of. He was whatever. One of the examples, I mean, this is really very negative for us, but one of the examples was the Inquisition. Now, Ferdinand... Yeah, the Inquisition is no joke. Ferdinand was not really king of Castile. He wasn't really king. He claimed to be, but he wasn't. The Castilians didn't recognize him as king. And in fact, after Isabella died, he did remarry. And if he would have had children that from his second wife, then the union in Spain would have been broken. But he didn't. So they went through the children of the first wife of Isabella. Anyway, so Ferdinand, who wasn't even really king of Castile, manages to convince the Pope to create something called the Spanish Inquisition. Now, the reason why it's called the Spanish Inquisition is the Spanish Inquisition has a very, very unique difference from the previous Inquisition. The Inquisition, before the Spanish Inquisition, is definitely used to, quote, persecute heretics. That's true. But the head of the Inquisition, the legal head of the Inquisition, was the papacy. And, for example, when the Jews originally were having problems in France in the 1200s, and the Frenchmen were a little, the Jews felt they went too far, the Jews appealed to the papacy, and initially the papacy said, okay, the Jews are right. Okay, later on the French figured a different way to throw the Jews out. But it was when the Inquisition was not in the monarch's hands, then there was appeal past. There was an appeal past the Inquisition. It appeal past the locals. You could go out and get somewhere. The Spanish Inquisition, the monarchy was in charge of it. And I don't have any full length biography of Ferdinand. So I'm not sure how. I don't know if anyone even knows how he managed to convince the papacy to do it. But it's a real ke'ilu in terms of as a ruler an accomplishment that this guy managed to convince the papacy to create something that the papacy didn't want to create. There were a lot of complaints about it, and he still convinced the papacy. The Inquisition was started in Castile in 1478, I believe. 1478. And even though there were a lot of complaints about it, and the papacy didn't like losing their authority, he was such a good politician, he convinced the papacy to extend it to Aragon in the early 1480s. From a Jewish point of history, the Spanish Inquisition is like one of those really bad words. Like up there with Auschwitz, etc. And I wouldn't even say anything about it. I would just leave it at that. However, in general history books, they do try to justify it. Now, I've even seen Jewish history books that try to justify it to a certain extent. I don't think they need that much comment. Which, again, you know, like, I mean, if the Jewish history books trying to justify it, I find more, amusing, disturbing, etc., because they're written by very liberal Jews, like overly liberal Jews. And, you know, I'm sure you guys all know this old statement, they're so open-minded their brains fell out.
They're so what?
They're so open-minded their brains fell out. What?
I heard the Shetu says
it. Oh, Shetu says it. Okay. Look. You understand that persecuting somebody because of religion, like, really goes against what liberals should believe. And you would think that they would at least maintain consistency and say that it was really bad that the Spanish persecuted the Jews because of religion. But it's not. That's not even it. You know, the Inquisition was instituted because, as we saw, you know, as they say, Judaism does not believe in looking for converts. We don't proselytize. We don't look for converts. Convert comes, we tell them to go take a hike. You really want to be Jewish? You don't want to be Jewish, do you? So, okay. So it's true that they don't believe that. They don't believe in that. Okay, that's one thing. But there's something that was going on here. It wasn't people who converted in their own free will and volition. It's people who were forcibly baptized. Or they were either literally forcibly taken to the water, dunked, and said, "You are Christian now." Or they were, one step better is, okay, here's a sword. You want to go there or I should kill you? Okay, that's like one stage, but that's like a half a step better. They at least have the opportunity to die al-Kiddush Hashem. But I mean, if they just literally take you and put you in the baptismal waters and say, "You're a Christian now," I mean, what are you, like, Kilo, what are you going to do? But the problem is, you're legal, according to Christian law, you're legally Christian. And that's why the Inquisition was instituted, because people like that were not that interested in being Christian, obviously, and reverted to Judaism, and that was considered heretics, you know, being heretical, and were killed as a result of that. Of course, the trials weren't really that fair, etc., etc., etc.
Why not?
Okay. Now, I just want to do two more things here, and then we'll finish it. Now, the fact that we find people justifying the Inquisition is like a very subtle expression of anti-Semitism. And maybe it's not so subtle. It says it's not so subtle.
Not so subtle.
Okay, you guys don't think it's not that subtle. It's transparent. Okay, you guys think it's transparent. But a lot of people wouldn't notice it. So is this something I think we should...
don't care.
Okay. That's one thing. And just to go on, the final expulsions we know is 1492. Ferdinand, again, who is really from Aragon, leads Castilian armies conquering Granada, the kingdom of Granada, the last Muslim kingdom in Spain, 1491. It's ironic, but not quite as ironic as previously, that the finances for the campaign were done by Jews. Financed the campaign for them.
Classic.
Yeah, well, no, it's not. I think it's more ironic. It's like, you can't blame. Barbonell was involved in financing that campaign. And you can't blame someone for that. For making the shidduch, you can blame somebody. That's called short-sighted, not in real touch. The people who made that decision may have been savvy in banking, but didn't really know that much about, you know, Judaism as a whole. Okay, fine. But financing this campaign, they didn't really have much of a choice. When you live in a country, you don't have much of a choice but to participate. But again, in 1491, after they finally conquered it, the Jews, it didn't take long for the expulsion to happen. No one's really 100% sure, of course. I'm just telling you having read through it in a number of, second or third hand sources, sounds like about a third of the Jews stayed in Spain, converted and stayed in Spain. A third of the Jews went to Portugal. And a third of the Jews went to North Africa, etc., etc., etc. That's the picture I get. But I'm not. You have to understand that no one knows 100%. This is very early modern. That, you know, the population of Spain at this point is like a question mark that no one's sure about. Like, I'll just give you an example. A census from the 1300s, from the late 1300s, claims there were 7.5 million people living in Castile. The tax records from the 1500s show there's only 3 million people paying taxes. And there were not major plagues in between the two.
They could just have not paid.
Okay, so
apparently there were 14 million Jews.
Okay, whatever. Anyway, the point is that statistics and census taking in early modern countries, and especially, Germans are going to be better about it than other people, but Germans have been into records for a long time. They're into records, Germans. But other countries are not as into records, and real censuses in early modern Europe are very big questions, and we're going to leave it at that. Okay, next week...